Hey Caffeinators, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe. The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses, hosted by myself, Dave Cowan, and my good friend Jeff Backus. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the veterinary field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. If you have a question, comment, or would like to be a guest on the Vet Tech Cafe, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com, or you can find us at our website, vettechcafe.com. One thing we would ask of you, our listeners, is to rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you're listening to. We're not exactly sure how or why this helps us, but apparently it does. So without further ado, come on in, grab yourself a cup of coffee, and get ready for another episode of the Vet Tech Cafe.
Hello, Caffeinators. Happy New Year. Hope everybody...
Happy New Year, everybody.
I hope everybody had a good holiday season and a happy and safe New Year. Dave, how's your New Year looking?
We're doing pretty good. I'm rolling now with my new career path of being a relief technician. Yeah. So things are good. I've forgotten how hard 12-hour shifts are, but
yeah,
I've done four of those in the last, five, 6 days. And today was my first like day off after all those. And I'm really enjoying the time off, but
nice.
Things are going good. How are you doing out there?
We're good. Because of the way my training fell with my new job with the Animal Poison Control Center, I had a 3-day weekend for both Christmas and for New Year's, which unheard of in our field. So that was pretty great. But I'm back on the phones this week, and so far so good. So 2021 so far off to a good start personally.
Yeah.
You got any good coffee going down there?
I do. I'm getting into my French press, and this is from Pete's Coffee Roasters. I just got in the grocery store, and it's Major Dickinson's blend. So it's
nice.
It's pretty strong.
Pretty strong stuff. Nice.
And what are you drinking?
I have, so the flavor leaves a little bit to be desired. It's polar peppermint, which whatever. I love peppermint coffee. And even though we don't get winter in Southern California, but it's still January. But it's Dunkin' Donuts brand. And you know,
peppermint is like some of the other stuff. I'm like, I'll give that like the caramel ones, the coconut ones, I'll give those a try. But peppermint is just, that's a no go for me.
It's so good. And I, you know, a big part of me does miss New England. So I'm happy to have donuts with me. So you found a cool article.
I did.
And this was in DVM 360.
Most recent edition that came out called Techs Just Want to Have Fun. And I don't know if anyone else is aware, but the world is on fire right now, or at least America is on fire.
Yeah.
So we wanted to avoid talking about any of that. And we want to talk about something fun.
Yeah.
So this is kind of a great little article. And I remember doing a lot of this stuff. And this is kind of the stuff that makes it a unicorn clinic, where you go to work and you have fun. And this is written by Christina Goldbrand, and just listed a bunch of stuff to actually have fun at work. And during COVID times and during these stressful times, it's important to have fun. And doing a lot of the things that I remember doing when I was working, you know, at some of these bigger clinics, the big one for me was Quesadilla Fridays. I remember we had quesadilla night every now and then at one of the practices I worked at, which was a lot of fun. What'd you think?
I loved it. You know, when I was at Tufts, especially as things were kind of getting crazy, we started doing the COVID bingos, and we did several iterations of that, and seemingly every day we had bingos. But to be honest, you know, it was largely a miserable time for a lot of reasons, but it gave us something else to think about and something else to have a little bit of fun with. And in my new job, even with Animal Poison Control Center, they did like a contest you could fill out via SurveyMonkey that was what your guess was for the last case number of the year, because they're done sequentially. And then also guess what the last toxin of the year was. So that was kind of fun. I have, of course, guessed that, given that this was ending at midnight on New Year's Eve, I guessed some kind of edible, but it was actually a rodenticide.
Weird.
Yeah, and I'm blown away how many rodenticide calls we get. But we also just this week, I think it was on Monday, did a modified version of bingo that was rodenticide bingo.
Really?
You know, all the different ingredients,
all
the unknowns, all the different ways that they could get in touch with it, or, you know, exposure to it. So, you know, it seems like it's not that big of a deal. It's really easy to do, but it's also really easy not to do. And it's just, I don't know, just something to kind of lighten the mood a little bit. And this was just, like you said, like a fun article, kind of, you know, just doing things we've probably all thought of. And maybe this would even be a great social media post. Like, what are people doing in their clinics to kind of have some fun? And then there was also downtime, fun time, which just sounds like a blast.
Yeah.
So there was some really cool ideas.
If we ever have downtime.
I know, right? Yeah. Yikes. Maybe in like 2023.
Yeah.
So yeah, just, you know, fun little things to kind of break up the stress and the chaos.
Yeah. Another thing we like to do is we would put on Pandora's One Hit Wonder Station and we'd play Name That Tune. That was always fun.
That is awesome. I love that idea. especially because, like, there's, you know, you as well, I'm sure, the older we get and the younger people are coming in that, like, don't know who the Beatles are, or, you know, like the songs that they may know or ones that we know.
Tom Cochran,
like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That could be a lot of fun too. I love it. So yeah, maybe we'll make a post on Facebook about what kind of fun clinic games are people doing, because
that'll come up next week.
Yeah. So keep an eye out for that. So we got a really cool episode tonight. I'm really excited for it. We have Deborah Calantropio Covington coming by the Vet Tech Cafe tonight, and she's got a BA in psychology and behavior from San Jose State in California. But ultimately, as many of us do, realized human medicine was not her wheelhouse. she worked in as an unregistered assistant for Banfield in the early 2000s and obtained her RVT license through the alternate route in 2008. Mad respect there. I'm also an alternate route grad in 2009. Did some private practice work, emergency clinic work, and then ultimately got working with a research organization and started down the lab animal path. Worked in a variety of species, including dogs, rodents, pigs, non-human primates, and then over the next few years got certifications as a lab animal technician, or an LAT, and a lab animal technologist, an LATG, and then ultimately went down the VTS lab animal nursing path and got that in, I believe it was 2017. She's now working for a large biopharmaceutical company, working with rodents for immune oncology and tumor modulation studies, and is also working on her master's degree in animal welfare, ethics, and law. Super cool stuff.
She's busy.
Yes, very, very busy. So, Deborah, thank you so much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe. I know we had a little bit of technical difficulty at the start tonight, but thank you for bearing with us. Can we get you a cup of coffee?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to be here. The thing is, I don't actually drink coffee, but I would take a delicious warm cup of, like, gingerbread tea. I think that would hit the spot right now.
All right.
We will put that on the menu. We can
make tea, yeah.
Yeah, we can definitely track that down.
It's a full-service cafe.
Yes, absolutely. Yes,
I love it, yes.
And we kind of always start out with having guests take us through their career path. And it sounds like, just like so many of our guests, it's kind of a long and winding road. So if you don't mind just kind of talking about what got you started in vet med and your path kind of all the way through the VTS process and what you're doing now.
Yeah, no problem. I feel like I'm kind of old when I hear everything read chronologically. Whoa, 20 years.
Yeah.
No. It hurts a little. But sure. So I started my career in veterinary medicine after I graduated from college. I was actually working at Happy Hollow Zoo here in San Jose. It's a very small zoo. They have a few carnivores, some hoofstock, goats. It's a very small zoo, but it's a very popular zoo. So I was working there, not as a vet tech, but just as a keeper. And I was also working at, you know, Petco, but I was the one who ultimately was taking all the animals to the vet at Petco. And then I got my degree and went, well, what am I going to do with this? Because I love animals and I don't really want to sit and talk to people about their problems. So what do I do? So I found a job at Banfield as an unregistered technician and started working there. I was lucky to have a couple of doctors that were very encouraging about growth and teaching people how to do things. We only had one strong, I can't even call her a technician because now that I think about it, she wasn't registered either. And she was kind of the head staff there. So she did a lot of training and kind of got me down that path. But one of the doctors was really like, you know, you have what it takes. You really should get your license. And nice. I'm very grateful for that because I really was like, well, no, why should I get my license? You know, the why should I? I'm already doing it kind of thing. I'm really, really happy that I was able to do the alternate route. Like you said, Jeff, mad respect. It's it's hard. It's a lot of hoops, and I don't recommend it. go to school, find a program. It's you'll get what you need a lot easier and without a lot of the stress. So yeah. I did that, and then I was in private practice and a couple of emergency clinics. You know, kind of like you said, I cannot do overnights. I realized that no amount of caffeine will work for me. I'm awake at 6, and when the sun goes down, I want to curl up in my bed. So overnights are also mad respect to all the technicians out there and everybody working in emergency clinics.
I always say that the overnight shifts are for the young.
Yeah. Okay, but now you're making me feel old again. See, we're going
back. Yeah, but you and I are in it together.
So yeah, we're in it together. We're in it together. We're going to be curled up in our beds by 9:30, and that's the way I like it.
Exactly.
So I did that, realized that wasn't really what I wanted to do, was working at a private practice hospital. And I just kind of felt like I hit a ceiling. And I worked with great doctors. I'm proud to say that I worked at a VCA with some pretty fantastic people in Los Gatos. And, you know, I love them, and I still take my animals there, and I highly recommend them. And I just realized that I wasn't really getting what I wanted, and I didn't know what I wanted at the time. So I put my resume out on, I think it was Monster. Are they still around? I don't know. Monster.com. How old are we? And I got a call from a recruiter saying that he was looking for a registered veterinary technician for a biopharmaceutical company. And I said, oh, what now? But I didn't know any of what that meant, because I didn't go through a structured program. So lab animal medicine wasn't even on my personal radar. So I was as green as I could possibly be. I said, sure, let's give it a try. And honestly, the money was better than private practice, marginally, but money was money back in 2012. And so I gave it a try, and really, again, I'm super grateful. I mean, I don't work there anymore, but I got just a wealth of experience from working in Menlo Park at this contract research organization. And basically what that is a bunch of other companies who don't have animals want to run animal studies, so they pay this other company to do it. So because of that, there's tons of different studies that are run, everything from surgical models to reproductive models, and there's a lot of different species. So I just kind of dove in headfirst working there with lots of different species. And then, you know, I got this amazing opportunity to work for an even bigger company developing life-saving drugs, and I took it, and now I'm old, and it's 2021. That's all caught up.
Gotcha.
And so now you're doing your master's degree program in animal welfare and ethics and law, and what drove you to go that route, and how is that going to advance your career?
You know, I feel like right now I'm working with rodents. And I do miss working with other species, you know, dogs, non-human primates. I love pigs. I would love to work with bats and, you know, zebrafish and everything like that. I love it. I wouldn't shy away from any species other than maybe spiders. I'd probably not be the first one to dive in with tarantulas. So I kind of felt like, you know, what do I do now? I'm a lifelong learner. If someone would just pay me to go to school for the rest of my life, I would absolutely do it. 100%.
How do we make that happen?
Right? How can we do that? Can I get just somebody to pay me to stay in school and learn things forever? But I got bills. I live in the Bay Area. Like, that's not an option. So I was kind of mulling around my options. You know, as Jeff mentioned, I have the lab animal certifications. I have my VTS, and where do I go from here? What can I do to advance myself personally? And if it advances my career, then that's great. But honestly, I just want to do it to learn new things. You know, there's the lab animal management test. I think it's called the CMAR. You can take that if you're into managing a lab, managing staff. You can also take an online lab animal management course through Drexel University. That's also very popular with a lot of people in lab animal. But it didn't sit right. Neither of those options they didn't really make me go, yes.
Are those typically technicians that do that, or is that non-veterinary people that are the managers?
It can be both. I actually work with a fantastic, I work with a fantastic supervisor right now who is also an RVT. He's from Georgia, so he's getting his California license now, but he managed a facility in Georgia. So you absolutely can do both. If you want to manage a facility as an RVT, you absolutely can. So it's great. I just, it didn't make me go, wow. So I was looking around online and, you know, I was like, what can I do? I like animals. I really like the welfare aspect of it. And I work with a group of people right now, and I'm very, very fortunate to work in a great place where everybody is really on the same page about animal welfare, about communicating it, about what the standards are. And that's super important. So I think I literally just Googled animal welfare school or job. I think I used the Google and it popped this in front of me. And I said, it's online. It's at my own pace. I'm lucky enough that I work at a company that will help reimburse for tuition as long as you pass your courses. So I couldn't turn it down because I can take 6 years to do this program if I want to, or I can stop at about 4 and just get a certificate in animal welfare, ethics, and law. And it's global. So we're discussing a lot of animals and their welfare, not just in lab animal, but food animal, companion animal, and just the differences globally. So it's pretty fascinating the first 11 weeks, I'm not going to lie. I really like it.
That's awesome. When you think about, you know, what your job looked like, you know, one question we've asked a lot of our guests is how was their job or their role changed as coronavirus kind of came in? Of course, in this profession, we can't really do remote. So, you know, a lot of different clinical setups and settings kind of changed. But for you in working in a lab, how did 2020 kind of evolve for you? And is 2021 looking any different with how you might do things going forward? Are there any major changes that have been adopted that may change the way you do things from here on out? Was there any major difference in what your job looked like?
Other than scheduling and keeping the minimum number of staff there right at the beginning, because we are considered essential personnel, and it's not just the veterinary technicians, it's everybody involved in animal husbandry. They're all essential. The lab has to keep running even if the studies are stopped, right? We have animals that we have to keep. So our staff was considered essential the entire time. And the way it worked in my particular situation, we have one other veterinary technician, and then we have our director, my veterinarian. And the three of us, we kind of tweaked the way we could be on site separate weeks and do medical case checks to make sure that we all three weren't on site at the same time. So our site was really good about ensuring people's safety as far as distancing goes. So that mostly was the biggest change for me, was not being on site Monday through Friday and having to do rotations, weekly rotations, and manage a lot of medical care remotely. Because if our technicians would find something with one of our animals, I'd have to be available to kind of walk them through, is this something, how do we treat this? How do we reach out to the primary investigator? What do we do if I'm not physically on site? Because they really didn't want anybody on site longer than they needed to be there. They didn't want people sitting at their desk if they didn't need to be there. So we have definitely moved into a different phase as of the end of last year. We have more people on site. We're doing the distancing. Even within the lab, we have to wear face masks, you know, anywhere on campus. But we are still doing the rotations where myself, my coworker, and my boss, we come in once a week and do a full round of medical checks. And then as things come up, if we're on site for study related work or another sort of meeting or something that has to happen, we can check the health cases then. But it's been very difficult to manage things remotely when I'm not there. Again, our counterpart facility in New Jersey, they do have larger animals. They do have non-human primates and dogs. I think for them, the veterinary staff do actually have to be there Monday through Friday, just because, you know, they do have USDA covered species.
Right.
So it might be a little bit more work for them. But again, as a rodent only facility, we've been able to manage it pretty smoothly. Like I said, we've got a really great team that kind of helps everybody. So
nice.
2021, nice. I think we are definitely doing studies. Investigators are pitching for studies. We are ordering animals for models, and we're doing our training, so we're anticipating to get more work and to keep going, because at the end of the day, you know, cancer doesn't stop because of coronavirus. So we have to get these drugs out to patients, and that's our motivation.
That's a great point. You know, one question I have for you, and something I didn't say in your bio, is you've recently joined me on the CARVTA Board of Directors, the California RVT Association. One question I would have is where do you see the technician profession right now? Like, why was joining a technician organization important to you? What's your outlook on things?
Well, I mean, up until this year, I had also been doing some relief work at my old clinic in Los Gatos, but unfortunately due to Corona, they were very strict on their allowance of people in the clinic who weren't working there routinely, just minimize the spread of potential pathogens, right? So I actually really appreciate being able to be a part of private practice medicine. I think what happens in research, one of the downfalls is that you kind of live in a bubble, right? So we don't know all about the latest new anesthetic drugs or the protocols or anything like that. And I was fortunate to have Anita, who's also on the board, as someone who would, you know, kind of motivate me and say, you know, hey, what about your fear-free training, right? Because that's not something that's infiltrated the research field yet, right? It's different. We do training, but it's not quite the same as fear-free and companion medicine. So I really think that being a part of private practice allows you to understand what's going on in the field, not just medically, but like you said, with technicians. And I think we're at a very crucial crossroads with the profession in general, not just in California, but nationally. I think we're all starting to have hard conversations about who we want to be and what standards we want to have and how we want to align that globally or nationally even. But I also think I have been honestly very disappointed with some of the comments that I've seen on some of the forums on social media when we as a field can't even agree that fear-free medicine is a good thing. Mm. You know, when we can't even agree, when we have people saying, well, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years, I deserve XYZ. It hurts me a little that we as a field don't want to advance the title and advance the certification. And if we can't align on that, I don't know how we're going to get the public to see it. I don't know how we're going to get our doctors to see it. Now, it's not up to just us. It isn't just the technician. We need regulatory bodies to hear us, and we need them to take their part and, you know, impose restrictions or fees or penalties or benefits to hiring credentialed people to, like, you know, title protection. We need other entities to be involved in that. But ultimately, we need to be more aligned because we're not right now. I don't see how we're going to get to the level of human nurses until we can all come together. So I'm excited for that in our future. And that's part of the reason why I do want to stay on the board. I want to get that outreach out there. I'm a very chatty person. I'm an extroverted person. Like, I'll go to the clinics and I'll ticker tape and flyer and be like, join this board, send this email. You know, I want to get that out there because we are important, and we really need to start standing up for who we are as a profession and what we deserve with that.
You kind of just answered a question that we typically ask of what is the biggest obstacle that we face in the profession. You just kind of answered that, like, without us even prompting it. So that's yeah, fantastic.
Perfect.
Yeah. And that's a great answer. And you're 100% right in every aspect, because that is the biggest problem is we don't have unity. Like, there's too much division on what we want to be called and what we think is the most important thing, you know, without getting into a whole VNI discussion.
Right.
You know, the nurse title seems to be the thing that's throwing the monkey wrench and everything, but coming together as one group to kind of align with, this is what we want and this is what we need. And we don't have that now, and we need to. Yeah.
We need to. Yeah.
That's the only way we're going to accomplish anything, really.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it is. Otherwise, we're going to go in circles for years and years and years. And I know change is slow. And I personally am not, I'm not a patient person. So I want these changes, you know, 5 days ago. I want these changes like 2 years ago. But any change, any step in the right direction is something. So having the conversations, that's a good start. Let's just hope that they keep going. We don't want them to stop or stall out or anything.
So let's transition into, you know, we could talk all night about that stuff, and and
for sure.
At some point we probably will, but let's transition into what you do as a lab animal technician. So take us kind of through a typical day of what you normally do as a lab animal technician. When you walk into work every day, what is on your list of things to do for the day?
Well, I will say that every lab animal vet tech is going to be a little different because mm-hmm. it's going to depend on what species you're working with, what kind of studies you're doing, or if you're doing, say, surgical model or medical device testing, that might involve you performing anesthesia on, say, a pig for 8 to 12 hours, right? So that's going to be a very different day than somebody like me who currently works with immuno-oncology, which is a rodent colony that has to be monitored. So I'll just kind of preface this with, it really depends on what kind of facility you're in.
Sure.
But as a typical day as a veterinary technician, you know, you generally, you come in and you're going to do a check-in with your husbandry staff, because at the end of the day, they're the ones who are in there every day, in every cage, looking at every animal as part of their job. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to do a check-in with them, whether that's electronic with medical records, or if that's via email, or you just go in and you talk with them about your animals. And if there's any health cases that have come up that are new, and you're going to kind of address them from there. And then beyond that, sometimes you have kind of chronic cases. So animals that are at facilities long-term, you know, think of, you know, dogs and cats and non-human primates, they may have kind of chronic issues that kind of have to be addressed. Just typically little things, you know, hair pulling, or, you know, a little pressure sore on the side of the toe or something that just needs to be monitored. So you go through your daily treatments or medications, whatever they may be. And then again, depending on the facility you work at, you may be assisting with receiving animals and doing health checks at receiving. You may be asked to help prep cages or get a room ready for a new species that's arriving. And at some point, you either daily or weekly or every other week, depending on the facility, you sit down with your veterinarian and you talk about the medical cases. You know, hey, these are new things that are coming up. Hey, we have this new study that's starting. They're going to use a special type of water, or they're going to be doing food restriction. Let's make sure we're all on the same page about how that's going to work, and make sure that we're all prepared for any adverse events, anything like that. And then a lot of it is admin or record keeping, because again, if you're working with USDA species, right, monkeys, dogs, cats, rabbits, guinea pigs, any of those, the record keeping is, it has to be precise.
Yeah, you got to document all that stuff.
Dot your I's and cross your T's, because somebody's going to come looking at that, and it better be spotless. So it's a lot of admin at that point. And then if you do have extra time, or you work with a large colony and you're lucky enough, you can do enrichment with a lot of these animals. You can, you know, with dogs, you can let them out in groups and literally lay on the floor and let a bunch of beagles jump all over you. You can make enrichment for your non-human primates or your rabbits and put it in with them and really watch these animals enjoy these things. So that's a great part of the job too.
You know, we kind of talked a little bit about it when I mentioned your bio, and we were kind of taking us through your career path. But for somebody listening that may be thinking like maybe lab animal is for me, what are good ways, or what would you recommend something to somebody that's wanting to start down a path of lab animal medicine? Like, where would somebody start with either education or, you know, kind of breaking into the field?
Yeah, of course. And we do need RVTs, non-RVTs, you know, we do need passionate, caring people in this field. So I definitely would encourage it. It is not a field for everybody. Some of the things that people know or think they know about lab animal medicine do involve euthanasia. And that is something that is difficult. It's always difficult. It's been difficult for me for years. It'll never not be difficult, but it is a necessary thing. But if that is something that you are uncomfortable with, research is going to be very difficult for you. But that being said, if you do want to get into the field, I would highly encourage people to visit the Americans for Medical Progress website. It's amprogress.org. And they are a research advocate program, and they focus on outreach and building that understanding and appreciation for necessary animal research. They have news, they have video clips of what it's like to work inside a vivarium as an animal husbandry technician. And they're beautiful videos, and they really change your perspective on the videos that people think they have seen from the 70s, when PETA took all their videos, and that's what people remember, and that's what's been passed down. So right. These videos absolutely show a different side, and I think that it's very important for people to see that, to see that that dogs are adopted after certain studies, that that non-human primates go to sanctuaries when they can, and it's beautiful, and people are laying on the floor hugging their pigs, and it's just wonderful, and that's not what people know. So I think that would be my first place to start. If they're in the veterinary field, I definitely think they should check out the ALA-VTN website, and that is where you can get information on becoming a VTS, if that's something that you're interested in doing. And that's the Academy of Lab Animal Veterinary Technician Nurse Specialty. So okay. That's going to have a lot of information, and I think that's ALAVTN.org as well.
Okay.
And there's also the Society for Lab Animal Veterinary Technicians, SLAVT. So any of those websites are going to be great for the veterinary-minded person to enter the field and to get ideas of how they can grow if they're not in the veterinary field, or they're an assistant and they are not thinking, hey, maybe I'm not going to get registered, but I really like working with animals. I want to give it a try. They can visit the ALAS website, the American Association for Lab Animal Science, AALAS.
These are great. We're gonna put all these on the show notes so that
yeah. You can make these
things up.
Yeah.
Shout out. Yeah. These are that's a great place for people to just get their feet wet and see if they like lab animal care. And the great thing about lab animal medicine is that RVTs can be anywhere. You know, I mentioned I have a supervisor who's an RVT. I also have a fantastic husbandry tech who's an RVT, two of them actually. So you can be anywhere from prepping cages and receiving animals and feeding animals every day, if that's your wheelhouse where you want to stay, all the way up to management and everything in between. You can be assisting with surgeries, and in some cases, even performing surgeries with some of the doctors. So there's a lot of opportunity for a lot of different people if they're willing to work in this field.
You know, when I think of lab animal technicians, I it's probably my ignorance. I'll admit that. I think of like rodents, mice, rats, things like that. And you mentioned like beagles and non-human primates. So what types of animals do you actually work with?
Currently I work with just mice, like okay. At least 10 different strains or more. And I actually work with Armenian hamsters, not Syrian hamsters. These guys are much friendlier. They don't bite, and they're gray, and they're adorable, and we love them so much. Unfortunately, they aren't a species that is native to California, so we had long talks with our director, and we were pleading with her, saying, like, what if you stay and neuter these kind of hamsters? Can we adopt them? And she looked into it, and the wildlife folks in California said, nah.
That's too bad.
I know, California, dang it. So right now, I'm working with just mice and Armenian hamsters. I believe in the future we may be working with rats. And at my past job, like you mentioned, lots of other species, larger animals and stuff like that, rabbits and nude guinea pigs. Those are funny. Weird little guys. They're just weird. They're just props to anybody who can own them, but they are weird.
Oh. You know, we've talked to a couple of lab animal folks throughout the course of our podcast. We had an episode with Steven Sattal and one with Noah Jones, and we talked a little bit about lab animal, but we didn't really have it as a focus. But one of the things that we kind of brought up is even in our profession, you know, in school or just in our profession, sometimes it's lab animal medicine is a difficult topic to talk about, or there's almost a stigma around it. And how do we break some of that down and just say, like, hey, we're all veterinary technicians. We're all working on these species. We're all still doing this out of love for these animals. And how do we kind of, do you have any thoughts on how to get past some of that?
Yeah, that's a hard one. And yeah. Steven and Noah, I'm sure they talk about this and they deal with this just as much as all of us in the lab animal field, and they're fantastic, very knowledgeable people. I would agree that there is a stigma publicly and in our profession. I think one of the best ways to start breaking that stigma is at the educational level. When these new VTechs are going through school, I think it's really important that they have more information on lab animal care, not just like, hey, this is a thing you can do. You can work with mice and dogs. Boop, you're done. Really hear from somebody who works in it. Get a guest speaker. Have them do what you're doing right now and ask questions like, well, what is your day like? I mean, how is it different? What are the pros and the cons? I think that's a great way to start. For the people that are in it, I think that's a little harder because that's pretty much akin to changing the public's perception of it, which unfortunately, a lot of that has to come from the lab animal field itself. And unfortunately, in the 70s, when all the information that was given to the public about lab animals was from animal extremist groups, the lab animal field didn't fight back. They didn't say, no, you're wrong. This is how we treat our animals. These are the bodies that govern us. We have more regulations on how my mice should be treated than your neighbor's dog who can be left out in the cold. People don't know that. And it's been many years that the perception has stayed that way. So it's kind of hardened in people's minds that lab animal medicine equals vivisection and torture and death. And it's going to be a long road to get away from that. And I think the more people that can talk about it proudly and the more people we can reach with things like Americans for Medical Progress and Biomedical Research Awareness Day, BRAD Day, that happens every April. I think we did two last year because of COVID, but that's coming up this year. And that's a huge outreach on, hey, this is what we do in lab animal medicine. This is who we are. We aren't these evil people in the shadows. We're not going and doing horrible things to animals. And by the way, this COVID vaccine that came out, who do you think are the unsung heroes that helped with that? It's your mice.
Right.
It's your llamas. It's your lab animals. Like, they're the ones who enabled this research to move forward. And I think the more people that really start to put two and two together, you know, the medications and the anesthetics that you're giving in the clinic, your ER drugs that you're giving to your patients in the ER, veterinary ER, those all came from lab animal medicine. And if people just take a minute to take that bottle of drug, any bottle off your shelf, you pull out that insert, that stupid little piece of paper with font so small, you can barely read it. You go through that and it's going to give you a bunch of information on lethal dose, toxicity, what kinds of studies they did, and those all came from animals.
Yeah.
So it's around you every day. People just don't want to see it because nobody's telling them to look.
Yeah.
And we need to start looking.
We will definitely put Brad Day on our calendar to
bring
some awareness to that.
We've already made a note of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yay. Awesome.
So in terms of lab animal technicians, do you feel like, I guess I don't know how many of you guys there are. So do you feel like you guys are well represented in the, like in NAFTA and, you know, your CARFTA? Do you feel like you're well represented as a whole?
I don't feel like we're very well represented. And I don't think that's the fault of the bodies that you mentioned. I was on the CVMA Veterinary Technician Board for 4 years as the research representative. And through no fault of theirs and through no fault of CARFTA, I just think that veterinary technicians don't know that it's a field they can go into. And again, because so many people can be unregistered and do many of the same jobs, there aren't as many of us as there are in private practice. So I think we need more veterinary technicians in research. And then the more of them there are, the more we can start unifying together. I mean, there are plenty of us for sure, but we're definitely not as large as private practice because of multiple factors. Mm-hmm. So the more of us there are, the more we can start talking together and meeting up in these groups. I think at the CVMA at the time, it was research and shelter representatives. And those are vastly different.
Yeah, people. Those are...
And that was very hard for me because I'm like, I don't have any connections in shelter medicine and I don't have the bandwidth to find it, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's another underrepresented group. Again, not CVMA's fault. They're there. they just might be too busy to know. It might be an outreach problem, right? So I think that things like this that really get the word out that like, hey, we exist. Hey, come and work with us. If it's your wheelhouse, the more we can really kind of unify as a profession within lab animal care.
Gotcha.
It's nobody's fault.
Right. Yeah. It just has kind of evolved this way. And here we are now.
Yeah.
Trying
yeah,
to pick up the pieces.
Exactly.
when you think about like your day-to-day job, and you mentioned the AALAS earlier, you know, what I taught as an adjunct professor for a little while in a alternate route vet tech program. And it's funny you mention about, you know, the lab animal lectures, because we had one lecture, and it was, you know, this species, we look at these kind of studies or we look at these kinds of things, but it was always a sensitive topic. It wasn't honestly presented as a viable career path, unfortunately.
Right.
But one thing I do remember from that lecture is we talked about the AALAS, the IACUC, and the AALAC, and some of the regulatory bodies and the process that goes into making sure that these animals are cared for as they're supposed to be. So would you take a minute and talk about some of that kind of oversight? Because there's layers there that I don't think, not just the general public, but people in our profession don't know exist. And that's like hugely important.
Oh yeah, 100%. You're absolutely right. People don't know it exists, right? And that does go back to the stigma that you can just do whatever you want to these animals. And it's literally akin to torture, when in reality, there are more regulations protecting one single mouse in my facility than there are your neighbor's dog or that lady who brings in her matted cat every 3 months because she doesn't take care of it. We have more regulations that say, you cannot move forward with this. This can never get that far. So you mentioned AALAC, and that's an international accreditation program. So that's any vivariums, any labs, all over the world. And it's an optional certification or an optional accreditation. It's similar to AHA. So you uphold your lab and your vivarium to a certain standard, and there are inspections. And if you meet those standards, you stay accredited. Yay. And if you don't meet those standards, you can have your accreditation removed if you don't fix them. So I want to say it's like over 50 countries, but anyway, if you have the accreditation, it kind of benefits your institution, and it raises the global benchmark for animal well-being, because to get accredited, you have to have an inspection. You have to meet certain standards as far as living space for your animals, enrichment for your animals, staff training, and proof of training that these people that are working there know what they're doing and what the training program does for them. So it's a complex accreditation. It's hard to get, but once you have it, you can keep it and maintain it just by following these rules and training your staff. So it's a big deal to those of us who have it. And in fact, my company just acquired another company last year. So we got another vivarium down in San Diego. They are part of our company, but that particular vivarium is not AALAC accredited. So we're actually working very hard right now to get them accredited, because they're part of our family now. So we want them to be accredited. We want them to be held to the same standards of care. So AALAC is huge, and more labs are taking part in being accredited, and it is a big deal. So within AALAS, the American Association for Lab Animal Science, so now we're back in just America, the IACUC, the IACUC, is the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee. So basically what that is, it's a group of people. They ensure that the scientists and the investigators are using the appropriate species, that they've done their research, and that this isn't duplicating something that's already been done without good reason. It has to include a veterinarian, it has to include a scientist and a non-scientist, and it can usually include somebody from outside the facility as well. And the IACUC meets, and they also inspect the facility twice a year. So they go in and they will check for expired items. They will ask staff members, you know, about things like their cage wash. Like, hey, what is the temperature that this cage wash needs to be run at to sterilize the primate cage appropriately, right? So it's a big deal that they meet and go over these things in every institution. And if for whatever reason, a study comes along and the ICA goes, no, we don't like this. This has been done before. I don't like the fact that you're not going to use analgesics. I don't think this is appropriate. They'll shut it down. They'll just say, no, you can't do it. So they are crucial for animal welfare. And again, every institution should have them. I don't see why they wouldn't. There might be a few, you know, rogue facilities out there who don't. But again, something most facilities strive to have, and it's generally not optional. It's the American Association for Lab Animal Science. They do a lot of outreach, and they actually have branches in every state. Actually, there's a northern and southern one in California. Yay, because we're so big. So they focus on educating within the lab animal staff. So if you're already working in a vivarium as a husbandry or a supervisor or, you know, any job, they focus on, they do things like webinars, they have educational opportunities, they have a national meeting every year that was virtual last year, and we'll see what happens if it makes it to Kansas this year or not. But they really focus on growth within the field. They bring a lot of new ideas. You know, it's a place where people within the field can share refinement ideas. They really focus on the three R's in research, reduction, refinement, and I'm forgetting the last one now because I've been talking too long.
Is it arithmetic?
Is it arithmetic? It's not recycling. I know that. No, don't say that because you can't recycle mice. It's replacement. So, right. You replace your animal model with a non-animal model, or you replace a higher species with a lower species. So if you can do the same research in mice that you could do in dogs, then you need to do it in mice. So ALAS is very big on promoting the three R's and technicians and staff to get these various certifications. And those certifications that Jeff mentioned, the LAT, the LATG, they go through everything from medical conditions to lab animals and how you would treat them to food storage. How many inches off the floor and from the wall does dry food need to be stored? I mean, wow. You're right.
That's crazy.
These are things in the lab animal field. Yeah, this food needs to be stored at this temperature. This is when it expires from the mill date. This particular species needs to be housed with others of its own species. You can't keep animals in solitary confinement without really good justification on your study protocol, and that has to get past your IA cook. They have to approve it.
I'm just thinking of all these regulations and thinking that like every practice I've ever worked in would be shut down because there's no way we'd have time to follow all these and make all these changes. And that's something you guys have to do every day. That's just crazy that you have to do all that.
That's why it's so important that people understand, again, your neighbor's dog that they don't feed or that sits outside and barks all night because it's stressed. That wouldn't happen in a lab. That would get shut down immediately. We would address that animal, and we would address the person who was in charge of caring for it and say, no, you got to fix this.
Yeah, owned animals don't have near the oversight or protection. You mentioning an example there of the food storage and such. Is that to minimize variables within studies, or is that, for food safety or those kinds of things?
I think it's a little bit of both. A scientist says, I want to run the study with mice, okay? And it gets past the IA cook and everything's approved. In that protocol, the scientist has to write out a protocol saying, this is the species, this is what I want to do, this is the method of treatment, whether it's, you know, subcutaneous injection, I'm going to draw blood once every 2 weeks, and then at the end, I want to collect these tissues, right? Very simple. In that protocol, there has to be some guidelines on how these animals are going to be housed and how they're going to be fed. And those usually reference an institutional SOP, standard operating procedure. So there's usually a husbandry SOP that says all food that comes in, you know, is going to be used by this date. This is where it's going to be stored. This is how the temperature it's going to be stored at. Because yes, like you mentioned, we don't want variables. I mean, we don't want food that's been sitting out, you know, in a hot room, because that might affect the study, not only because it's warm, but it may affect the quality of it. If this food is supposed to be irradiated, for example, which some lab diets are, to reduce pathogens inside your facility, we need to make sure that this food stays stable and stays as uniform as possible. So it's a little bit of both. Nobody wants variables in their studies. That's
right, for money. Sure.
Yeah.
That's wasted money, wasted time, right. and wasted animal life.
So Deborah, as a VTS in lab animal medicine, I can't even imagine what's on your skills list. I'm assuming you draw, I don't even know where you draw blood from on a mice, on mice. What types of skills do you have? Like, are there case reports? I know with the other VTSs, there's case reports on individual animals where you're working with multiple animals at a time. I would imagine your case report studies are vastly different than the other VTSs are.
It is a little different for sure. There's actually three different exams that you can take to be a VTS because, as I mentioned, research is very, very different. You could spend 12 hours of your day performing anesthesia and recovering animals, or you could spend a majority of your time doing nursing, which is what I do, or you could actually be the one performing the surgery. Again, that is an option for some technicians and for some staff to learn how to actually perform insertion of medical devicing or anything like that. So the requirements to be a research anesthetist or a research surgeon are going to be a little different than researching clinical nursing. I would say that the majority of lab animal vet techs probably would go the clinical nursing route, which is what I did, providing project support, veterinary care, but not necessarily doing 70% of my time performing anesthesia. Mm-hmm. But if that's what you do, you definitely have a route you can go. I can't speak to what their requirements are, but they're pretty similar. You do have to have worked with traditional species, and you can work with non-traditional species. So your reptiles, your fish, you know, crayfish, ghost fish, you know, any of those things. But your traditional species, your mice, your gerbils and dogs and stuff like that, you do have to do case studies. You do have to do case reports, case logs. They recommend, I believe, 50 case logs and four in-depth case reports where you have to discuss in depth, for mine, the nursing one, your nursing care for this animal, right? So you had a rabbit who had reproductive surgery. You walk through what you did from a nursing perspective from start to finish, right? So animal was pre-oxygenated. Vitals were taken via, you know, XYZ, pre-medicated with this compound via this route, intubated using the V-gel or mask, right? So you go through your entire point with that animal, what you did. And you do have to, they have to be a little bit different. You can't just say, oh, I got four rabbit procedures, I'm done, right? They want to see the emergency. They want to see that you know what to do if there is a study that happens and you've got an adverse reaction and you've got a rat that's beat. What do you do? What is your nursing care? Who do you contact? So it is very in-depth. And I think it took probably about, you have to be in the field 5 years, I think, before you even start.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to tell you, it took me about a year and a half to get everything I needed. And then there's the test.
Of course, like, that
once
test.
Once you get your stuff in and you get that little thumbs up, like, sure, you can take it. Now you got to study for the test. Mm-hmm. And it is, you guys, it's no joke. I know Steven, I'm just going to call him out. Like, I know he designed some of these questions, and you guys, they were hard. they were hard. And some of them had pictures of radiographs and ECGs that you had to know. And they want you to know that because you're still a nurse.
Yeah.
You're still a nurse. And I'm like, I got to review my waves. Oh no, what? So, I mean, it's no joke. They really want to know that you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
They will work with you, the academy. There's a mentoring program. So if anybody out there is hears this or thinks they want to go that route and they're in the lab animal field, they have a fabulous support group and we can absolutely get you there, but they want to know that you know your stuff.
Nice.
So yeah, once you take the test, you get it. And then in 5 years, you have to renew and keep up on your CE, just like everybody else. Again, really show that you're committed to this profession and this part of your field. They want to see that.
Gotcha. Well, we're just about out of time, so I kind of want to start wrapping up here. But the one last question I have for you is, take a minute and advocate for being a lab animal technician. What would you say, or how would you recruit somebody that might want to, you know, might have an interest in this, but, you know, isn't sure, you know, is there anything else you want to kind of get out to our listeners that maybe we haven't touched on yet, or just take a minute and advocate for being a lab animal technician?
Yeah, I absolutely will advocate for being a lab animal technician. 100%, you guys, that's what I'm here for. Yeah, it's an unsung part of our field for sure. I mean, I know that veterinary technicians in general don't get a lot of glory as a field, but definitely as the field goes, we are kind of still in the shadows. So I think it's important for any of us that are there to make our voices heard and say, we're here, we exist, we do good things, we help all of you, we help your families, we help your children. So don't forget about us. You don't have to join us if you don't want to. You keep doing you and taking care of those animals in the clinic and at your zoos and everything, absolutely essential. But just realize that we are all connected, as Jeff kind of eloquently put it, we're all in the same field. And at the end of the day, we're all caring for animals and we're advocating for them. We are their voice. And in lab animal medicine, it's so important that they have a voice, because again, the stigma. And right. I think that, yeah, there's just a horrible stigma, and we have to stand up for them. And we have to tell people that these animals are well cared for, and they do such a service for humanity. I can't say it enough. I mean, the vaccine that's coming out, I mean, y'all better go out and hug a mouse, because they're the ones that you go out and you leave a piece of cheese for your neighborhood mouse, because they're the ones who help get this moving. And it's something that I want everybody, if they take nothing away from all of my blabbering on, is that this is an important field to be in. And the more people we have that understand that we are a voice for them and that we are their advocate and that we do have empathy and compassion for these animals, the more people we can reach with that, I think the more people will start to open their eyes and say, you know what, maybe research isn't so bad after all. I think I'm okay with it. And maybe they'll pass that on to one more person.
Yeah.
So I want everyone to know that if they have any questions, I'm on LinkedIn. You can absolutely reach out to me. I'm happy to talk to you about anything in lab animal care. But, you know, take care of each other and try to reduce the stigma. There's enough ugliness in the world right now that we don't need to be ugly to each other in the field and have that stigma about people in this profession.
Amen. Awesome.
Well said. Well, Deborah, before we finish up, we have one final question for you. Your Vet Tech Cafe Would You Rather question. Are you ready for it?
Oh, this is exciting. I am. I'm excited.
All right. Jeff, we're doing number one?
Yeah, go for it.
All right. So, Deborah, would you rather only be able to whisper or only be able to shout?
What? Oh, man. Oh man, as somebody who's had vocal cord issues, I don't like either of these options.
Oh.
My ENT would kill me. Whispering is terrible for you.
If I had to pick one,
it is. Whispering is actually worse for you than shouting, because you're tensing the cords up so much. So they actually say that whispering is actually worse for you. You want to talk in my ENT said Julie Andrews voice. You want to talk softly, but with enough oomph. You want to talk like Harry Poppins. Huh. You don't want to shout and you don't want to whisper. Like, yeah, that's never going to happen. So if I had to pick one, I would probably say whispering, because if I shout too much, I'm just going to lose my voice. And then no one would get to hear me ramble on.
Very true. Very true.
Excellent.
Right? I like it. Well, Deborah, thank you so much for your time and for coming by for that gingerbread tea. And talking about lab animal medicine, because like I said, we've talked to Steven about it a little bit. We talked to Noah a little bit about it and we haven't had a whole episode that focused on it. And we're trying to get out there to all of our listeners that there are so many corners of this field that kind of go unrecognized, but we're all in the same boat. I mean, we're all doing the same things, mm-hmm. just doing it different ways. And, so we really appreciate your time kind of talking about what your career looks like. So,
yeah, thank you so much for having me. This is great. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for being here. And I have one more thing before we go.
Oh.
Deborah, you can join me in congratulating Jeff on winning the fantasy football championship belts.
Yes.
And cape and you got a, there and was a scepter there.
Yes.
Is there anything else that was there?
Well, I don't know. It all arrives from New Hampshire on Friday. So there'll probably be a photo online.
Yes. That's congratulations, amazing. Chef.
Congrats,
Thank you.
Chef.
Thank you.
Awesome. I love it. I want to see there's gotta be photos of this.
There will be photos. Don't you worry.
Yeah. There will be photos. And thanks. I appreciate it.
Fantastic.
All right, everybody. Well, thanks for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe. Caffeinators, I hope you guys are all well. I hope 2021 is better for you guys than 2020 was. Hopefully the clients are nice. Hopefully we can start talking to clients again, seeing clients again soon. And if you're in line for vaccine, by golly, like Deborah said, go out and hug a mouse and and tell them thank you, because when you get down to it, that's really where it came from, right?
That's right.
So, all right. Have a good night, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Hey, Caffeinators. We would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. As you guys are well aware by now, we often talk about difficult issues that face our profession, and we chat with colleagues and leaders in our field who have strong opinions of these issues. Those opinions expressed by either Dave and I as the hosts, or those opinions expressed by our guests, are their opinions alone and do not represent any other person, any other business or institution, or any other entity with or within the scope of veterinary medicine. If you have any questions relating to this, please feel free to email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. You can check out our website, vettechcafe.com. And please, whatever podcast form you're using to listen to our episodes, like us, follow us there, like us and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. And lastly, have a great day, Caffeinators. You guys are awesome. Bye, guys.